Okay, thank you, Bruno. So this kind of lengthy title of my talk is Simulated Climate Change Impacts and Model Uncertainty Associated with Multiple Potato Models. And for those of you who are not familiar, this is part of the AgMIP initiative, which is the Agricultural Model Intercomparison and Improvement Project, which is, there's also a session tomorrow afternoon meeting on some of these topics as well. So the focus of my talk is to explain some of the uncertainty among using multiple crop models for the same commodity, which happens to be for potato, and then also looking at using an ensemble of these models, what some of the climate change predictions would be at different locations across the world. So I want to point out this is also, excuse me, a highly interdisciplinary and institutional oriented project. I've been leading the project along with support from the International Potato Center with Bruno Condori and Roberto Quiros. And I have 28 co-authors on this project representing 10 different international institutions. This is very much an international effort. So I want to, by way kind of background, explain why we're doing intercomparison studies in the first place. And I think anybody who does a model knows that there are abstractions of reality. And because of that, there are simplifications of it. Okay. And so sort of by logical consequence, they're also going to be limited in terms of what we're applying them for. And thinking about crop models, sort of a consequence of this is that the representation of how different model developers are going to try to describe soil plant atmospheric science is going to differ. And case in point, the AgMIP modeling intercomparison studies have shown that, they've incorporated multiple models for the same commodity. So for example, wheat had 28 models, maize had 23, rice had 13, at least at the time of the first publications, and potato plot, which we'll talk about today, has got 9. And one kind of interesting side note is that a majority of these were not initially developed to do climate change responses. Okay, so this is going to be important to look at the ensemble responses. So you may have all these different models for the same commodity, but because they're sort of developed differently, you can get in a situation that you may get different results from multiple models, even though you're giving them the same input data. And that's really kind of what we want to quantify today, is what is that uncertainty among those models? Is one model going to be better than another, or are we better off using an ensemble approach, like the previous speaker was talking about with using the GCMs? And so sort of an outline for today, what I want to cover is by using a model intercomparison, we want to improve our confidence in the modeling tools for potato. We want to know, are the models actually different when we subject them to common data sets? If they're not the same, how are they different? And then what do we do about it? So I'll kind of talk about bits and pieces of those three objectives. So there were 9 contributing models in the pilot, and what we did is, we give 4 different common data sets to each of the modeling groups. And so this would represent 1 year of experimental data for each of these 4 locations. And so these are major potato production regions throughout the world. They're really extremely contrasting in terms of the climate, the soils, the genetics, and the management practices. In fact, the 2 sites, the U.S., Washington State in the U.S., and Denmark, were so-called high-input sites. So they were chemical fertilizers, automatic irrigation, and then we had sites in Bolivia, South America, and Burundi, Africa, and these were so-called low-input, where we had organic fertilizer and rain-fed production. And the yields, historically, are over a 10-fold difference. Okay, so this is a pretty extreme test to see how well the models are agreeing or not on these common data sets. And we did this in 2 phases, and this is a similar protocol to what the other AgMIP intercomparison studies used. So phase 1 was this low calibration, or sometimes referred to it as a blind study. And so maybe ergonomic data is not the right word, but really what we didn't provide the modelers with any of the yield or dry matter or any in-season information. All the modelers were given was the soil data, any management information, and climate data. And from that, they had to kind of do a rough calibration of their models. And then we looked at some combinations after the year corresponding to the experimental data. We looked at variations in CO2, air temperature, and W's rainfall patterns. And the one that I'll talk about most today is this full calibration. And this is a typical case for most modelers. Well, they have access to all the experimental data, including yield, dry matter throughout the season, time series data. And so we did these studies, and we also did a factorial combination looking at 5 levels of CO2, temperature, and 3 levels of rainfall at those sites. So this graph is maybe a lot of information, but it's going to be the same pattern I'll show you for the next couple of slides. So what we're just looking at for this presentation is the end of season tuber dry yield on the y-axis, and then you have our four so-called our sentinel sites or our data sites. And on the x-axis, you have the observed data for that single year that we use for the calibration, and that's the standard error around that point. And then we use box plots to represent the nine model results. Okay, so this kind of gives you a sense of just the visual distribution of the models. P1 was a partial calibration phase, and then P2 was the full calibration. And just a couple notes from here. So you can see, without doing any calibration, that what's interesting is the median of those model distributions is represented by the solid black line. And this was generally closer to the observed value than the mean. You particularly see that in the case of Denmark. In the U.S., you can kind of throw out that statement because they were both median and mean was way off. After you do the full calibration, you can see, not surprisingly, that we're much closer. Again, the median tended to be better than the mean. And this is a response that we saw with the other AgMIP crop intercomparison pilots. The variation, as we would expect, is reduced among the models after calibration, which we would hope. And in fact, if you were to do analysis of variance on that, you would find that there was no significant difference among models within the given experimental site. So everything looks good. We're happy. Okay. Then we take 30 years of historical data at each site using that same calibration point, and now we've got a different story. Again, now the blue is the low calibration, and the red is the high calibration. So again, you see the variability is going to be reduced as you go from low to high. One thing which I won't be able to get into much detail today, but we did see if you look at the coefficient of variation as an indicator of variability or uncertainty among the models, we generally have more variability at the low input sites. And I'll mention that at the conclusion because I think it was a pretty interesting finding. Looking at the previous slide, to this slide, the variation among those models is a lot greater. So that's pretty concerning because we had calibrated already for those sites, at least for the one weather year. And so if you were to do analysis of variance, now we know the models are significantly different. And so that is a bit troubling, not surprising, but it is a bit concerning about how we're going to apply these models. So we're going to change focus a little bit and just stick with the full calibration phase. And what I want to do is kind of go rather quickly through some of the CO2 temperature and rainfall studies using the ensemble collection of models. And so what you're looking at here is the full calibration. These are our four data sites. And then we start with a 360 part per million CO2 concentration. And that's sort of the historical value that we used for calibration. And then we kept everything else the same except we moved the 90 part per million intervals. And so the first thing you kind of see within a given site, just looking at the median line, that the responses are increasing. And this is what we'd expect. We see this in C3 crops. You have a positive response to CO2 enrichment. And in fact, if you were to compare this with literature, we're getting about 12 to 41% between 360 and 720, and this is actually really pretty consistent with what we've seen experimentally. So that was encouraging. If you wanted to quantify the median yield response for those nine models to every 100 part per million increase in CO2, it's about 0.3 to 1.5 megagrams of tuber dry yield per hectare. Okay. An interesting thing, and maybe a good thing from the modeling standpoint, is the variability really did not increase among the models as you go to higher CO2 levels. And so that means that the models are generally, the way they're implementing CO2 must be fairly consistent across the models. Okay, now something interesting happens when you look at temperature sensitivity. This is the same idea, but now the zero mark is where we left daily min-max values alone, and then we looked at minus 3 degrees Celsius, and then looked at different increments of plus 3, plus 6, plus 9 degrees Celsius applied to the historical values on a daily basis. And again, the trends are actually what we'd expect. Potato is a cool season crop, and so if you increase temperature in most locations, you're going to end up impacting yield for a variety of reasons. So the negative response was not unexpected, and if looking at the median, these declines range from anywhere from 29 to 45%. And that actually is not that far off from what we see in the literature. Of course, it would depend on the location they're being grown at. What was very eye-opening, and again, I think Senthold mentioned this in the wheat pilot, was that the variability among those models increases greatly as temperature is increasing. So that tells us that the way temperature is being implemented in those models is widely contrasting. Okay, so that's a target for where if we want to improve the models, that may be a place to look at. The last single factor climate response we'll look at is rainfall. And so I just show Bolivia and Burundi because these were our rain-fed sites. The irrigated sites, of course, are not that impacted by the rainfall, at least from a yield standpoint. And you can ignore all these other symbols on here. I apologize for that. But basically, the trend is as you increase rainfall, you're increasing the yield. And that makes intuitive sense. This is as expected. You generally have a linear increase, at least these sites, for increasing rainfall. And just to confuse you, I go the other direction. So if you have a 10% decline in rainfall each day, you've got about roughly 2% decline in tuber dry yield. Okay, so none of these results are surprising. The one thing I did see is if you look at the coefficient of variation again, that variability among models is actually increasing with decreased rainfall. So that means, that tells me that as the plants are getting more stressed, there's more and more disagreement among the models. Okay, so we saw high temperature was an issue, and now we're seeing high water stress becoming an issue as increasing the variation among the models. Okay. There's a ton of information on this slide, and so what I want to try to do is more convey what's happening. And so this is the best way I could find to represent three factorial combinations on tuber dry matter yield. So what I did, and actually we have a paper that just got published on this, is I kind of merged the low input sites together, Bolivia and Burundi together on this top row, and then Denmark and the U.S. on the bottom row. And then each of these boxes is basically a CO2 on the y-axis and a temperature combination. And you're looking at the contour lines are percent change, looking at the median value of those models, percent change from historical or from the experimental yield that we calibrated the models against. And then these columns represent differences in rainfall. So just taking the 0% change in rainfall from what we used historically and looking at the Denmark-U.S. combination, the zero mark here and the 360 part per million mark right where that cursor is, that's the baseline value. Okay. And just to show you what's kind of neat is if you just kind of went straight up this line here, you're just changing increasing CO2. If you go just to the right direction, you're increasing temperature, and you see the values, the yield values are dropping quite a bit. So the real value in this, I think, is that it's sort of an approach that we could use to use the ensemble predictions of these models to kind of estimate what potential climate change factors could be on yield in major potato growing regions. And so you kind of can see in an eyeball, or at least a graphical image, what these could be. And that's really, I think, a powerful implementation of sort of a modeling ensemble approach. So I'll leave that point alone. Probably more we can say about that, but that's good for now. I thought this was interesting, too. This is showing kind of the underlying variability among those models. Okay, so the same exact data we looked at before, but now instead of plotting the median change in historical yields, now we're looking at the uncertainty among those models in terms of the coefficient of variation. Okay, so again, this is if we keep with the same limit, this is kind of where we are, historical conditions. The red actually means less variability. Yellow, green, blue means you're increasing the variability among the models. And in a sense, basically, you're increasing the uncertainty among the models. So if you, like we said, if you go straight up, you're just increasing the CO2. The variability really isn't changing all that much. But you can see, regardless of which box we're looking at, as you go left to right, you're changing temperature, you're increasing your uncertainty. Okay. And you can imagine we have this developed for other responses as well. My clock stopped running, so I have to trust you. 2 minutes. Okay. So quickly, what do we do with this? And I won't spend too much time on this, but again, borrowing a page from what Senthuttle done for the wheat pilot, we want to ask ourselves, if we want to use an ensemble approach to make predictions, how many models do we need to kind of keep our variability or uncertainty below a certain threshold amount? And that threshold, a good representation, could be what the field variation would be experimentally. And for potato, that's about 17%, and that's what this dashed line is. And then on the x-axis, you're looking at different random combinations of those nine models. And the take-home message is to get below that coefficient of variation, you would basically need to have either five partially calibrated models or three fully calibrated models. So if someone's looking at doing a climate change study, perhaps they can look at this and say, okay, we need to use three of these models randomly selected to get below that variability. Okay, so to wrap things up, this is my summary. Maybe I'll just stop and see if there's questions rather than taking up the rest of that time. But I just will end that these results were pretty similar to other pilots. The one thing that I thought was unique to the potato, at least that hasn't been reported yet, is that I did see a lot more uncertainty among the models for these low input sites. And again, this goes back to the idea that as stresses increase, whether it's nitrogen or water, we're seeing more and more variation among the models. And we could have a whole discussion just on that as well, I think. And that's some topics to explore in the future. But let me stop there.